Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup. The channels to peace in the Middle East are being cleared again, and a new sense of momentum has developed in the peace process. Doug Sager reports from Cairo.
Military talks between the Egyptian and Israeli defense ministers resume this evening at the Tahrir Palace. No date has yet been set for resumption of the Jerusalem political sessions Egypt called off nearly 2 weeks ago. But American mediation efforts in Jerusalem have resulted in a reported draft of negotiating principles. Assistant Secretary of State Alfred Atherton is meeting with Egyptian Foreign Minister Mohammed Ibrahim Kamel here in Cairo to discuss the American-Israeli draft. Atherton says his talks with Kamel are meant to be informal and exploratory. No real bargaining is expected here until Anwar Sadat returns from his trip to the United States and Europe late next week. But this morning at Cairo Airport, Israeli Defense Chief Ezer Weitzman told reporters he hopes for substantial achievements in Cairo, not just talks. Weitzman brought along his wife and son, and he was smiling and relaxed. But it remains to be seen whether compromise is possible between Egypt and Israel on the two issues which broke up the last round of talks, Israel's Sinai settlement and the rights of the Palestinians. Doug Sager for CBS News, Cairo.
Emissaries of hardline Arab countries opposing the Egyptian-Israeli peace moves gathered in Algiers this morning, and Doug Tunnell has the story on that.
Only five flags are flying above the conference table in Algiers. Foreign ministers and delegates from the hardline Arab states and the PLO have convened their meetings here, even though Iraq has refused to join them. It is called the Front for Steadfastness, created in hopes of counteracting the Egyptian-Israeli peace initiative and supporting Syria as the only remaining confrontation state on Israel's border. But it had a troubled birth. Iraq walked out of the last front meeting in Tripoli, Libya, and all the Arab diplomacy since then has failed to bring the Iraqis back into the fold. The reason is that Iraq still looks upon Syria and the PLO as being far too moderate in their stand against Sadat and against peace. Both the Syrians and the PLO have held on to their option to join negotiations with Israel in the future. Iraq rejected that option long ago. And until the others do so, Anwar Sadat's Arab rivals are likely to remain divided on just how far their policy of refusal should go. Doug Tunnell, CBS News, Algiers.
Kuwait's oil minister says today that his country and the other major oil exporting nations have suffered heavy losses because of the continuing decline of the U.S. dollar. As a result, he says, we're now losing about 20% of the value of our oil. The U.S. government reports that the index of leading economic indicators rose a moderate 0.7% in December, and the minus originally reported for November has been revised to a modest plus. Four of the indicators were down, five up, one unchanged. In the past week, the problem of Earth-orbiting satellites with nuclear material aboard has suddenly assumed an air of urgency. President Carter underscored the fact at yesterday's news conference when he called for a total prohibition on such devices and said he would urge Soviet Russia to join in an agreement to that effect. CBS News diplomatic correspondent Marvin Kalb reports on the way this could be accomplished.
The effort will probably be made at the United Nations, and it is certain that Canada and Japan will lead it. But now President Carter has put the United States squarely behind a new international agreement banning nuclear-powered satellites from orbiting the Earth. Since the United States no longer uses nuclear power cells in its Earth-orbiting satellites, the Soviet Union would either have to change the technology of its spy-in-the-sky satellites or else reject this international appeal. Either way, the thrust of the president's proposal is that Russia has to pay a price, no one else. This is the result of the fact that one of Russia's spy satellites developed trouble last week, and it had to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, throwing radioactive debris at different points in northwestern Canada. For a time, it appeared as though the satellite would have to burn up over the Pacific between Hawaii and Canada or the western coast of Africa. It could just as easily have hit a heavily populated area, causing many casualties, but everyone lucked out in this respect, and it did not. Marvin Kalb, CBS News, the State Department.
American and Canadian scientists are expected to go back to the Warden's Grove area in the Northwest Territories today for further examination of the satellite debris. The area is cordoned off and is under police and military guard. Ohio today is still digging out of the worst blizzard in its history, and Bob Fall reports from Columbus that the state is still adding up its losses.
Governor James Rhodes says property damage, livestock destruction, and production layoffs will total $300 million plus cleanup costs, exceeding the $13 million already spent by the state. The damage estimates will climb because some farm losses haven't been reported and because commercial barge traffic along the Ohio River is still stymied by ice jams, delaying transport of badly needed fuel and supplies into the crippled Ohio River Valley. And as cold weather continues here, Ohio's coal supply keeps dwindling. Stockpiles, wet or frozen, don't burn well, but with a nationwide coal strike, dry coal, which is needed, just isn't available. So utilities here have urged both homes and industry to cut back consumption by 25%. But yesterday, the voluntary conservation measures saved only half that amount, and power companies now warn that if that trend continues, tough mandatory cutbacks will be needed. Bob Fall, CBS News, Columbus, Ohio.
Governor Rhodes already has warned that unless the nationwide coal strike is settled soon, Ohio will start running out of electricity. Barry Serafin in Washington takes a look at the status of efforts to end the walkout.
No one involved in the talks, miners, mine operators, or federal mediators, describes the bargaining as broken off. Instead, they use words such as suspension, pause, and recess. The careful semantics are an indication of the fragile nature of the on-again, off-again talks, which are now hung up on money. Mediators say a wide gap exists between miners and mine operators over how much money will go into wages and benefits. But there has been tentative agreement on the industry guaranteeing health benefits, which now depend on how much coal is produced. An agreement, too, is reported on procedures aimed at curbing chronic wildcat strikes in the coal fields. One reason the administration is not eager to invoke Taft-Hartley authority to suspend the strike is fear of jeopardizing what has already been negotiated. Then, too, there is speculation that the miners might refuse to go back to work, Taft-Hartley or no Taft-Hartley. Barry Serafin, CBS News, Washington.
At yesterday's news conference, the president ruled out, for the time being, any move to invoke Taft-Hartley provisions in the coal strike. Such action could be taken in a national emergency, the president said, but we certainly haven't arrived at that point. Mr. Carter defended the administration's decision to fire David Marston from his post as U.S. Attorney for Eastern Pennsylvania. The president said he saw no conflict between that action and his campaign promises to take politics out of Justice Department appointments. He acted routinely, he said, in relaying to Attorney General Griffin Bell the request of Democratic Representative Joshua Eilberg that Marston's dismissal be expedited. If it occurred now, the president said, I would do the same. Forceful new action against South Africa's racial policies is being debated today in the United Nations Security Council. We'll hear about it from Richard C. Hottolet.
The African members of the Security Council are asking the Council to consider tough new economic pressure to push South Africa away from its apartheid policy of racial segregation. But if they press ahead with their ideas, they will almost certainly be rebuffed by the Western members. The text of one draft resolution circulated last night by the Africans is based on Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which gives the Council emergency powers to meet threats to international peace and security. It would call on all states to prohibit loans to or investments in South Africa by corporations and banks, as well as by their own official agencies. The Western powers were ready last fall to place a mandatory arms embargo on South Africa, but that was a limited move compared to the economic pressures now suggested. The West is inclined to think that so drastic a procedure might be self-defeating, putting South Africa's back to the wall instead of making it relax its internal repressive policy. Richard C. Hottle at CBS News, United Nations.
U.S. and British diplomats are holding their second day of talks with Rhodesian black guerrilla leaders on the Mediterranean island of Malta. They're hoping to reach agreement on how to bring a black government to power in Salisbury. Prime Minister Ian Smith has been meeting in Salisbury with moderate black leaders. One of them, Bishop Abel Muzorewa, boycotted yesterday's session because, he said, he had been insulted by white Rhodesian officials. But a spokesman for the bishop says this morning that differences between him and the government negotiators have been satisfactorily resolved, and the talks, he says, will resume in Salisbury tomorrow with Muzorewa taking part.